Brazil. Just a few facts and figures before going into the main part of this discussion. Brazil is the largest Latin American country, and economically speaking, in South America, it's the most powerful industrially. If you look at the map of South America, it's probably close to something like half the continent is Brazil. It's a potentially rich country, rich in natural resources. Just to list some of the minerals that they've got is bauxite, gold, iron ore, manganese, nickel, phosphates, platinum, tin, uranium, petroleum, hydropower, timber. In terms of population, it's about 190 million. And they practically all speak Portuguese. There's a few small minorities, but most of them speak Portuguese. Just about half the population is white, just over half. The rest of it is a mix of blacks, mixed race, black, white, etc. On that, by the way, this government is proposing a law which would force Brazilians, at the moment, if on your ID card or your passport, everybody born in Brazil is Brazilian. They want to introduce a law which says either Brazilian or Afro-Brazilian, which means that you'd have to define whether you're of African descent. Now, when there's a huge part of the population is actually mixed, and the comrades that we're in touch with are actually campaigning against it. This is an issue which the petty bourgeois are putting forward as a kind of positive development to combat racism, when in actual fact it would force people to declare what race they belong to, and it's actually a divisive thing and not solving the problem. The economy of Brazil, as I said, it far outweighs that of any other South American country, and it's an expanding economy, although with the contradictions of a former colonial country, let's say. It's undergoing growth, although not as fast as the average economic growth at the present moment. GDP growth last year was 3.7%, which is quite low compared to the figures if you look at some other Latin American countries, in particular Venezuela, but if you look at China, Southeast Asia, etc. So there is a problem there on the economic front. GDP is $8,800 per head, which is actually quite high. If you look at the countries, the advanced capitalist countries, and the extremely poor countries, it's a relatively developed country. When we talk about the third world, actually, it's not really a very precise term. The third world gives the idea of backward, poor, shanty towns and dust roads and all that kind of stuff. Brazil has some of this, but if you go to Sao Paulo, you would think you're in any modern city in terms of the infrastructure, etc. Even the makeup of the GDP, by sector, if you look at it, agriculture represents 8%, industry 30%, and the services 54%. That's actually, if you look at the industry, it's a higher percentage of the Brazilian economy than it is now in Britain. If you wanted to be pedantic, you'd have to say that Britain is a third world country compared to Brazil in terms of the makeup of the economy. And there's a lot of jokes about the fact that may actually be true. Unemployment unemployment is close to 10%. And the percentage of the population living below the poverty level is 31%, which shows you the contradictions in the system. The lowest 10% of the population consume only 0.7% of total consumption, whereas the top 10% consume more than 31% of overall. So it shows you the enormous polarization in society. And if you look at the Gini index, which I've mentioned in other lead-offs, they consider that once the Gini index goes above 40, then you're looking at instability and political turmoil, etc. And most of Latin American countries are well beyond 40, but the figure I have here from the CIA fact book is incredible. It's 56.7, which means it's an enormous polarization between rich and poor, and which indicates, from their point of view, a potentially unstable position. The public debt is 50% of GDP. The exports of Brazil, obviously, it's a relatively developed, although it's still, you still class it in the list of the underdeveloped countries relative to the advanced countries. It depends largely for exports, and the biggest export market is the United States, which is close to 20% of Brazil's exports go to America. Now, that's a significant point to take into account. I'm not going to have a discussion on world perspectives, but all the indicators for the U.S. economy is that consumption is slowing down, the housing bubble has finished. They're really worried about the level of debt in the United States and that it could be a sudden contraction of the market. The United States actually consumes 29% of world GDP, and therefore a slowdown in the USA will have a knock-on effect all around the world. And as we can see, it would have an effect on countries like Brazil. It's logical that its next partner is Argentina, which is the next, it's an equally quite developed country in Latin America. And the third is China. There's a lot of links now, economic links with China. China's investing a lot of money in Brazil. It's looking for the raw materials. China's actually sucking in raw materials from everywhere. And close to 6% of Brazilian exports go to China. And also, it's more or less the same figure the other way around. Imports, the main imports are from the USA, and China is fourth on the list after Germany. The external debt last year was $176 billion, in spite of the growth. Now, Brazil used to be a Portuguese colony. That's why it's the only country in Latin America which speaks Portuguese, as opposed to the others which speak Spanish. It achieved formal independence in 1822, but for a long period, the military were involved in power in running the country. Between the 1930s and the 1980s, the military were in and out of power. And between 1965 and 85, there was a military dictatorship in Brazil. It's as recent as 85, the military rule. Now, after the Second World War, Brazil underwent quite rapid industrialization. This created a modern working class. And when we go back to Marx, who referred to capitalism creates its own gravediggers, i.e. the development of capitalism has a positive side to it, in that the main progressive element in it is that it creates the working class. It creates the class which is the basis for the struggle for socialism. And in creating a modern working class, we saw in the 70s a massive struggle of the, particularly the metal workers, which led to the creation of the PT, which is the Workers' Party. Lula, who is the president of Brazil now, was one of the leading figures of the metal workers. He was a metal worker himself, and led the trade union struggles. And this then led, in turn, to the creation of the PT, which eventually was registered and recognized as a party, and became very quickly the main party of the Brazilian workers, the party of the mass of the workers orientated to. Now, this party eventually, I'm obviously giving a very brief outline here. In 2002, this party eventually won the presidential elections and Lula became the president. And again in 2006, where they had the Lula stood for the second time and won the second election. It's significant what happened. This government of Lula, which has always been a coalition government, although he won the presidential election, the PT does not have an absolute majority in parliament. They governed with a series of bourgeois parties, and this led to a certain disillusionment, a certain fall in membership of the party, also falling away of activity. You know, if we want to look for the Latin American Tony Blair, you'd have to say it was Lula. He's the polar opposite of Chavez within the Latin American continent, or Latin America, sorry. Whereas Chavez is in conflict with imperialism, Lula is seen as an agent of imperialism. He carries out the diktats and the desires. For instance, he sends troops to Haiti and behaves in a manner, for instance, threatening Bolivia when the government there raised the question of nationalization of the hydrocarbons, because it was threatening Brazilian interests. And Lula, who's supposed to be the defender of the interests of the working class, in actual fact, internationally, was defending the interests of imperialism and of the Brazilian ruling class itself. Now, in spite of this, in the elections, what happened was interesting. In the first elections, he had a drop in votes. In the first round, sorry, because it's a two-round system, like in France. And the two top candidates then stand in the second ballot. Because it was a shock, the result of the first round, Lula actually radicalized his campaign in between the first and the second, and came out with speeches like, "This is about the rich against the poor," and he made quite a radical position. And actually, that led to the party winning not just the votes of a passive layer that hadn't voted. He actually won votes away from some of the bourgeois parties. People swung back to the PT, which shows you the potential the PT has if it stands on the issues, on working class issues. Of course, Lula did that to win the election, but in terms of his policies, he's carrying on with the same. Now, it's a contradictory policy, I would say, the politics of this government. He's tried to carry out a policy, sort of anti-inflationary policy, same policies, for instance, that we have in Britain. If you see what The Economist says, the public debt remains high at around 45% of GDP, and it says social security expenditure is on an unsustainable path. Because, you know, we mustn't be one-sided in looking at Lula. For instance, he's introduced, which is something I'll touch on later on, the Bolsa Familiar. Basically, he's introduced a kind of minimum wage that's given to the poorer families, but it's paid by the state. It's kind of social security payment to alleviate the worst of the poverty. And they say this, obviously, it's unsustainable from the point of view of the bourgeois. In the past, Brazil was considered a miracle economy. Now it's still growing, but as I said, it's below the average. In the past 4 years, the average growth for developing countries was actually 7.3%, and Brazil has been 3.3%. So within this picture, it's actually on the slowdown. It says, The Economist actually says that he won the elections because he had significant support from some of the poorer layers. And they talk about handouts from the federal government, which has achieved this. And in fact, there's one area I was reading, which is an extremely poor area, that used to be a sort of a fiefdom of some of the bourgeois parties. Lula got 70% in some of these poor areas, even in these last elections. They're seeing some benefit, even from this government, which is probably the most moderate of these left governments. Overall, however, in spite of this policy, poverty levels have remained very high. It says here that more than half the population, actually, this is an article from April of this year, lives below the official poverty line. But the Bolsa Familia, which benefits, it says, 95 reais a month. And part of the deal is that you've got to send your kids to school if you want to keep the money and this kind of stuff. And it reaches 46 million people, a quarter of the Brazilian population, some of the poorest of the population, have received this this aid. Now, of course, this is this also partially, I would say, partially explains the results, that the poor can see that in spite of the policies of Lula, the alternative is the direct representatives of the bourgeois parties, and the poor don't want that. Just to give one example of the huge differences, when I gave those statistics, here they translate it into what it means, and it talks about a neighborhood in Rio de Janeiro. It says, the road that separates Gavea, a rich neighborhood of Rio, from Rocinha, a favela or a slum, is dominated by gangs of drug dealers, marks, and listen to the difference between these two areas. A ninefold difference in unemployment, therefore in the favelas unemployment is 9 times higher, a 17-fold difference in income, and a 13-year variation in life expectancy. These are the differences, and these neighborhoods are very close to each other. Now, in one of these, in the Northeast, Lula actually won 77% of the vote. And they talk about the higher pension costs, which have been introduced as a result. But side by side with this is a policy of privatization, liberalization, an attempt to attack pension levels. Basically, this second term Lula government represents a further shift to the right, and it's under pressure to undo some of the reforms that he's carried out and to completely liberalize the Brazilian economy and put it in line with the interests of the IMF and World Bank. Now, at the same time as Lula was elected in 2002, we had in Brazil a spate of factory occupations. I think 14 factories at one point were occupied. 5 of them successfully were taken over by the workers and run by the workers. Now, in the leadership of this movement was this group that we're now in touch with. Some of the comrades have been to Barcelona will have met 2 of them. They were in Barcelona in August of last year. They've set up a coordinating committee of the occupied factories, and they've been running them. Among them, Cipla, which is a factory that makes plastic products like plastic pipes, toilet seat systems, parts for motors, etc., which is a sizable factory of over 800 workers. It was run by the workers for nearly 5 years. Together with that is Interfibra, another factory with about 100 workers, and these two are in Joinville, which is a town in the deep south in the state of Santa Catarina in Brazil. There's another factory, the Flasco, which is a factory of about 70 workers in the state of Sao Paulo, which is also being run by the workers. Now, how did the boss of Cipla behave? For 30 years, no new machinery, no investment. For 10 years, prior to his abandoning the factory in 2002, this boss had received state subsidies, and on that basis, kept production going. Once the subsidies had finished, typically, like a lot of these bosses, he abandoned production, abandoned the factory, which shows you how parasitic this bourgeoisie is, depending on the state subsidies. Now, not only did he take subsidies off the state, he didn't pay taxes and didn't pay any insurance contributions, leaving a huge debt. 80% of the debt of Cipla is actually with the state, in one way or another, either directly through taxation that wasn't paid or unpaid contributions to the Ministry of Social Security. Now, that is why it's logical the leadership of the factory under this Marxist group that we're in touch with, that they've always posed the question, workers' control, but nationalisation, and have demanded of the government and have demanded of Lula that he nationalises the factory, and they're saying 80% of the debt is with the government. You've got every argument in your favour to argue for nationalisation. Take the factory; it belongs to you. It's owed to you. Instead, how did the state in Brazil and the government react? With a general swing to the left in the country and pressure generalised, not just in Brazil but in the whole of Latin America, they tolerated the existence of these occupied factories. The workers have managed to keep this factory going, producing, selling, and surviving. They had a deal also with the Venezuelan government, which was providing the raw materials. In exchange, the workers at Cipla were providing know-how, and there's a factory being built in Venezuela. One of the things they are very good at is PVC windows, doors, and walls. They can actually build houses. I saw one of them. They had it in the plant. It was being used as an office, but it was a typical house which had bathroom, kitchen, living room, and bedroom. Very nice house compared to the horrible favelas that you have in Brazil or even in Venezuela, in the poor areas. And one of these houses costs $5,000 to build, and within a week you can have it up. And they were providing the know-how and the technology for Venezuela, because Venezuela has the biggest public housing project in the world after China, in numbers. The difference is China has a few more people than Venezuela. China has 1,300,000,000 people, and Venezuela has about 27 million. Therefore, proportionally, it's huge. It gives you it actually gives you a taste of how the real problems of ordinary poor people can be solved. Here we have the technical know-how, we have the raw materials. The South America is a rich continent in raw materials. We have a huge housing problem, with immense problems in the peripheries of the major cities of all of Latin America. And here we have a skilled workforce that is able to provide a way out, i.e. building what are very reasonable civilized houses. If you want two bedrooms, by the way, it's only $8,000.